United States Code, Title 20, Congress finds the following. Disability is a natural part of the human experience and in no way diminishes the right of individuals to participate in or contribute to society. Improving educational results for children with disabilities is an essential element of our national policy of ensuring equality of opportunity, full participation, independent living, and economic self-sufficiency for individuals with disabilities.
Good morning, and welcome to the first in our series of podcasts on how state education officials can improve special education outcomes by focusing on results-driven accountability. My name is Andrew Henry. I'm the founder of Red Cedar Solutions Group, and we are the creators of Stepwell, a web-based platform that helps drive continuous improvement in special education with automated best practices and visibility into special education systems, processes, and results. Over the next 6 months, we'll be exploring the implementation of special education programs. Our goal is to provide you with real stories and share some of the collective experiences of special education administrators, parents, students, and others around the system. Our hope is to humanize that system and to help you think about your own systems. But first, let's step back for a few moments and think about what brought us here in the first place.
You know, Andrew, when I think of the special ed system, I don't think of it in terms of SVP indicators or data points. I think of it in terms of a specialized purpose and a specialized vision, and also a privilege to educate learners that have complex needs. From an educator's standpoint, I see that as a prime challenge. I see working with kids with disabilities as a professional privilege. To do anything less than that diminishes our profession.
That's Beth Steenwick. Beth is a former teacher, state special education administrator, innovator, consultant, and relentless pursuer of improvement. When I ask her, what do you see as the key characteristics of a quality special education system? Here's what she told me.
You know, in general education administration, we have a lot of direction on how to define quality. We spend a ton of time focusing on educational leadership, curriculum aligned to standards, educational performance of students, data-driven continuous improvement, and evidence-based practices. Whether you liked or hated the No Child Left Behind Act, you know, we refer to that as ESSA now, it was instrumental in making a systemic review of what was happening in your district and buildings and helping us pay attention to the picture that review painted. In special education, we've been somewhat adjunct to those conversations, maybe for good reason, because kids with disabilities pose some unique learning challenges that aren't as easy to understand or capture systemically. Many educators would tell you that they can't take the time to investigate and focus on implementing improvement because our measures of success are heavily weighted towards compliance and the never-ending stream of paperwork and reporting that goes along with it. So, what are the pieces of a healthy special education system? In my opinion, they're not different than general ed. They are strong leadership, high-quality instructional practices and implementing evidence-based practices, ongoing professional development, technical assistance, coaching, data analysis, monitoring and evaluation for the purpose of continuous improvement. In order to move from compliance to results, we need to place a greater focus on the underlying issues that impede our ability to deliver quality services across these domains. We need to use monitoring as a tool or a window into our ongoing program performance and our system performance, as opposed to a checklist that we discard when we have finished that monitoring activity. Only then can we tell the story about how we've done, whether or not we have challenges, and how we can improve. This is how we get to the results-driven accountability.
Results-driven accountability. It requires more than just a shift in thinking. It requires a new approach to how state education departments and their local implementing agencies collect and analyze student information. The process must go well beyond the what that is being measured and intentionally and sometimes uncomfortably ask the question, why did this happen?
You know, as adults, we forget that we create the systems that produce the trends, that produce the results we get from our programs. Often those results are not what we want or things that we don't like. Sometimes we have a tendency to blame those results on a myriad of actors. You can figure out who those actors are in your own neck of the woods. Yet in my experience, there are a lot of things that are well within our control to change and influence without assigning blame. Committing to looking in the mirror and honestly and regularly assessing what we see is critical. After 42 years in this business, I still think I've got a lot to learn.
Beth's talking about conducting a root cause analysis. It's the most important element of any improvement planning process. It's the process of gathering, studying, and making a plan based on underlying issues, instead of jumping to conclusions based on presumed cause or preconceived notion. Put simply, it's the act of being curious and examining and challenging your ability to change. I asked Beth to share some practical experience with using root cause analysis to change institutional behaviors.
You know, Andrew, that concept of root cause analysis is really just about digging deeper and asking that why question until we get to the bottom of the issue. You know, I had an experience with a district that had a dress code requiring kids to wear uniforms. This happened to be a Title I building, and ostensibly, the purpose behind the dress code was to relieve the pressure on families who couldn't keep up with the unending expense of fashionable clothing. Unfortunately, the district underestimated the kids' desire to end run the dress code. What was happening was that kids would come to school not following guidelines and then be sent to the office and processed for violations. Infractions were always identified in the first and second hour class, which also happened to be when the school scheduled its core curriculum, like math, English language arts classes. Well, it didn't take long for academic performance to drop, discipline issues to go off the chart, because of course, kids were kids, and what were they doing on their way to the office? Lingering, fighting, skipping out, being kids. So when they contacted me, they had concluded that their positive behavior and intervention support systems weren't working. I wasn't so sure, so we sat down and looked at the data. If we had relied on only that data, it would have been a reasonable conclusion. But then we started digging a little deeper, asking the questions. Where are all these discipline referrals coming from? Why are they going to the office in the first place? Well, as we dug, it became a little more clear. It was the dress code. We took this a step further and asked ourselves, so what are our beliefs about the dress code? What are our beliefs about the kids? Are there ways we can address them without making office referrals? What we concluded was as adults, we were creating our own problems with the dress code. While the purpose was laudable, we reinforced a system that was in turn reinforcing an unfortunate perception that the kids were discipline problems.
So, you might assume that this story ends with the district dropping the dress code, but that's not what happened. After consideration and debate, they determined that the core intent was still reasonable and benefited many families. Instead, they changed their procedural approach to morning transition time and began greeting kids at the door. In this way, they were able to support the kids as they began their day, and they diverted students who didn't meet the dress code to a uniform closet. The additional supervision also helped the kids get to class on time. The school was able to dramatically reduce their discipline referrals, and their math and ELA scores went up significantly because kids were in class and ready to learn. One of the difficulties of results-driven accountability is that we're often measuring our success based on what happened a year or two ago. It's difficult to shift our thinking from looking backward to looking forward, but it's absolutely essential to learning to identify trends in the data. Often we're dealing with what is above the waterline, what we can see. What we need to do is go below the line and uncover why the system is producing these trends. Sometimes this requires more than just reviewing available data. It might require qualitative inputs and probing questions that help determine whether our perceptions of what kids can and can't do, should and shouldn't do, is in keeping with cultural norms, and whether changes need to be made to strengthen, update, or eliminate policies, practices, and procedures that fail to produce quality outcomes.
You know, Andrew, that process of root cause, I talk about it as the iceberg method. Let's see the whole iceberg below the waterline. I think that's something that I've learned in the consulting work I do. is that when you enter a situation like that school district that I was sharing, that story I was sharing, that starts teaching us how to think about how to get under that waterline. I use that experience in a recent experience with another leadership team who I consider to be very innovative and willing to tackle any problem that comes along. They had a particular challenge with their kindergarten and first grade kids, and the kids were acting out, struggling with the resiliency and self-control, showing an inability to navigate problems and problem solve. By the end of the first semester, everybody was fatigued. They had so many office discipline referrals, it was making their heads spin. We took a look at those referrals and asked them questions like, when are these discipline issues coming up? And where in the building are they coming up? Turns out the majority were occurring during transition times, specifically first in the morning and again at lunchtime, and typically in the early part of the semester. This particular building was used as a pod system very successfully. That pod system requires lots of transitions throughout the day. While this was fine with the building's older kids that have gotten used to that system, some of those transitions, hallways and common areas in particular, were very challenging and overwhelming to the younger kids. The next question we asked was, how are we implementing our positive behavior interventions and support systems? We then reviewed their PBIS practices and we learned that while they did a very good job at the beginning of the year of explicitly instructing in all parts of the buildings what was expected of kids, it started falling by the wayside as the year progressed and wasn't consistently reinforced. In addition to that, the reinforcement system for the kids was not implemented consistently. The result? Mad chaos. And adults super fatigued. So we brainstormed ways that we could improve outcomes for kids while working within the building's infrastructure. We agreed that specials teachers, whenever possible, would come into the classroom or come to the classroom to walk the kids down to the specials. We talked about eating lunch in the classroom during the first few weeks of school or using older kids as lunchtime mentors to the younger kids. It ended up being a win-win for everybody.
So to recap today's thinking, compliance. It's a small piece of the quality pie, but one that can be used to shed light on what we know and help inspire our curiosity about why we're seeing what we're seeing. We can use tools, data systems, and software like those we produce here at Red Cedar to help give us that window and to drive the questions behind our root cause analysis. We can bolster our data with experiential information like surveys and inputs about beliefs and norms to help assess whether policies, practices, and procedures are supporting or impeding performance. And we can use this information to drive improvements that lead to strengthening leadership, curriculum, professional preparation, and student performance.
Hey, Andrew.
Yes, Beth?
Let's not forget that while we don't control what students come to us with, we are capable of rising to challenges with positive responses. From my perspective, that's what being an educator is all about. And it's a privilege to serve our communities in this endeavor.
And there you have it for today. Thanks for joining, and be sure to listen to our next discussion on empowering teams to evaluate special education data. I'm Andrew Henry, and this podcast and content were created by Red Cedar Solutions Group, developers of Stepwell, a software solution that empowers users to collaborate for results.